Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. The second leading cause of blindness in the world is glaucoma. It's often a silent problem that progresses very, very slowly, causing the loss of peripheral vision. It's estimated that maybe 1 million people in the United States have glaucoma and are not aware of it. Our guest today is a specialist in this area. It's Dr. Elizabeth Morgan. She's an Anchorage ophthalmologist. She's been practicing here for about 8 years after doing some training on the West Coast, and in particular did an extra amount of training as a fellowship in glaucoma work at Swedish Memorial Center in Seattle. This is the second time Dr. Morgan has been on the program talking about glaucoma, and I want to welcome her back. Thanks very much for taking the time again.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
I guess one of the hardest jobs I can envision in radio is having somebody describe the eye and how the function of it works that might be pertinent to listeners so they can understand glaucoma. So take it away. Help me understand what's the important anatomy and physiology of the eye.
Absolutely. I think before talking about the anatomy and physiology, it's probably more important to define glaucoma because it's going to help us figure out what to focus on. So what glaucoma is it is a disease that affects the health of a structure called the optic nerve. You want to think of the optic nerve as a wire that's going to transmit information acquired by the eyeball back to the brain, where the brain interprets that information. So again, the optic nerve is the critical structure of the eye when we're talking about glaucoma, because that is where the damage is going to occur. Now, the next question is, okay, well, how does that damage occur? Well, we know that it occurs because the pressure in a given eye gets too high for the health of that eye. So you next have to ask yourself, okay, well, what determines pressure in the eye? Pressure in the eye is determined by a balance between how rapidly fluid is made inside the eye and, in turn, how rapidly it exits the eye. So what I mean by that is there's a structure inside the eye behind the lens called the ciliary body. And the ciliary body's job is to pump out fluid inside the eye at a rate of 2.5 microliters per minute. So it pumps out that fluid, and then that fluid in turn makes its way into the internal drain of the eye. Now, another name that you will hear us refer to as the internal drain is called the angle of the eye. And the reason we call it that is because the internal drain of the eye sits in an angle formed by the intersection of the iris and the cornea. So, again, the pertinent anatomical points in the eye when you're talking about glaucoma is, number one, the optic nerve, which is what is damaged. Number two, the ciliary body, which is making fluid within the eye. And number three, the internal drain of the eye, where fluid is exiting the eye. What happens in glaucoma is the pressure gets too high because that drain isn't draining the way that it should. The ciliary body is going to, for the most part, always pump out that fluid at a steady rate. But it's going to get clogged up at the drain in glaucoma.
So let me make ask a couple of questions. Why do we have to have fluid? What's the purpose of the fluid, and where in the eye is that fluid?
So the fluid, for the most part, is in a segment of the eye called the anterior segment. So think of the eye as being divided into two compartments. There's an anterior segment and a posterior segment. Now, the posterior segment has a big ball of jelly that gives it its shape and provides it nutrients. That's called the vitreous. In the anterior segment, or front of the eye, that's where that fluid that the ciliary body is making flows. And the name of that fluid is aqueous humor. And what is within that fluid, think of it basically as bathing the anterior segment of the eye with nutrients.
Okay. And that anterior segment is that cornea, which is the front of the eye that kind of bulges out and is irregular with people who have astigmatism. And then the iris is that colored portion of the eye, and it's that angle where the problem is. In the middle of that iris hangs that lens that we look through that we're going to talk a little bit about next week, which is where cataracts form.
That's exactly right.
All right, so the fluid is providing nutrients because there's no blood supply to the cornea and the lens and the iris?
That's correct.
Huh, okay. All right, so it's a different way, and so the mechanism of supplying the nutrient is through this ciliary body, and the problem doesn't seem to be with the ciliary body. It's what's in that fluid that gums up the drainage mechanism, either because genetically it's not set up right, it's because of age factors. What all makes that drainage a problem?
Well, it's actually not the fluid itself that's gumming it up, but somehow there is dysfunction of the drain itself.
Okay.
And in the most common type of glaucoma, which we refer to as primary open-angle glaucoma, we really don't know why that drain quits draining the way that it should. And it's a major point of controversy among glaucoma specialists, because if we could pinpoint exactly where the problem is, then we would come up with very targeted therapy for fixing it. But we don't exactly know which part of the drain the problem occurs in. Now, there are other types of glaucoma where we call these secondary types of glaucoma, where we know what's gumming up the drain. For example, let's say someone gets hit in the eye and they get blood in the anterior chamber of the eye. Well, that blood has to be cleared, and that blood is going to be cleared by going through that drain. That blood can clog up the drain, and that can lead to a type of glaucoma, which is secondary traumatic glaucoma. But there, I could go on and on about the number of secondary glaucomas that exist. And then, you know, we know what's clogging up the drain in those.
So let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Morkin, and our topic is glaucoma. If you've got questions, comments, anything you want to say about the issue of glaucoma or questions you might want to ask, let me give you some contact information. Our local number is 550-8433. 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and an email address, which is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we can take your questions over the next hour or so. So do other animals get glaucoma as well, or is this a human problem?
No, animals get glaucoma, and you tend to see it. Let's take dogs, for example. You're going to see glaucoma in dogs that have a short skeletal structure to their face. For example, in bulldogs, because bulldogs have been bred to have this short, squatty face, which makes them really cute, but it has caused significant problems, one of them being glaucoma, because now you have this eye that has to fit within this very small, bony space that in turn is going to cause pressure on the drain and lead to glaucoma. So, you can see it in other species.
I'm interested, since it's an obstructive phenomenon, how big this area is, and then, you know, with the right equipment and so forth, can you actually look at the drainage area and see that it's obstructed? Is that part of it? And then I guess that's the logical next question is, surgically, can you open it up?
Yeah. So one of the things I do when I am first evaluating an individual with glaucoma is I look at the drain. And the way that I look at the drain is by utilizing a lens that has mirrors on it. And I place that lens on the surface of the eye, and those mirrors direct light so that you can actually directly visualize the internal drain of the eye. By doing that, I'm able to see if the internal drain is open or if it's narrow or if it has debris in it that's clogged it up. Or if it has scar in it, because what that's going to do is it's going to help me figure out what type of glaucoma I am dealing with, thereby helping me figure out what sort of therapy is going to best serve the patient. And let me back up a little bit to make myself perhaps a little bit more clear. When we're talking about the different types of glaucoma, there are two large camps you can divide it into. One is going to be open-angle glaucoma, which is what we were referring to earlier, and the second is going to be narrow-angle glaucoma. Narrow-angle glaucoma is exactly what it sounds like. The internal drain is narrow, And that is what is preventing fluid from exiting the eye at the rate that it should. And that's what's causing the pressure to go up. And I can talk at length about narrow-angle glaucoma and the differences in the way the disease presents, if you would like at this point, or we can defer that to later.
Yeah, well, let's come back to that. I know we have a phone call already, and I want to take that, and I certainly would like to get back to the differences. And also, we need to ferret out a little bit more, perhaps, on how that pressure damages the optic nerve as well. Heather, you're on line one.
Thank you. Dr. Morgan, I hesitate to deal in old wives' tales, but I have three questions. Two of them probably are old wives' tales. I have been told that one can exercise the eyes by, staring certain directions or looking up hard or looking down hard, and that either delays or prevents glaucoma. I also wonder about excessive watering of the eyes, whether that is any kind of indication of glaucoma. And third, and a more concrete thing, is my grandmother, my mother, my sister, and I all have glaucoma. One, do more women get it than men? Or two, does this mean that my daughter and or my son are also going to have glaucoma?
Heather, you want a job? You can. good questions.
All right. So, Heather, in terms of exercising the eye, no, that is, in fact, a wives' tale. Exercising the eye is not going to prevent glaucoma, nor is it going to have an effect on the pressure in the eye. The only time moving the eye around actually has an effect on the pressure is in people who have thyroid eye disease. And in those individuals, if they look into upward, it tends to raise the pressure in the eye. But otherwise, that's a wives' tale, Heather. Number two, regarding watering. In babies, tearing is actually one of the first signs of glaucoma. However, in adults, tearing is not at all a sign of glaucoma. Tearing typically represents irritation of the surface of the eye. And let me just make a comment, which is frequently confusing to people. When I talked about how fluid circulates in the eye and then exits the eye through the internal drain, this is all fluid within the eye. This is not the tears that you notice, which is on the surface of the eye, which is a totally different compartment. Quick answer, watering, no, that is not a sign of glaucoma. Now, family history, on the other hand, is one of our greatest risk factors for glaucoma. And the fact that you do have such a strong family history indicates that there's a high probability that there is a genetic loci within your family that has predisposed your family to glaucoma. Is a consequence, the individuals within your family should get screened, perhaps starting at an earlier age than most. And what I recommend there is that they should see an ophthalmologist at least by the age of 20 for a dilated fundoscopic exam to see if they've got any signs of glaucoma. There is no sex predilection for the disease. So females versus males, it's about even.
About dominant recessive. I mean, it sounds like in her family, this is a pretty common thing, which would suggest it's an autosomal dominant since there's no sexual or relationship.
You know, in terms of the, if we just want to quickly jump to the genetics of glaucoma, there's really only been two defined glaucoma genes as of present, the myosin gene and the optineurin gene. And both of these are autosomal dominant genes, and you can be tested for those. The myosin gene represents 3-4% of all glaucomas, the optineurin even less than that. That being said, we are constantly identifying new genes now that we have the ability to, now that we have mapped the human genome, and whether your family, Heather, actually has the myosin gene or optineurin gene is a possibility, but it may be an entirely different gene.
Still, a minority of people have those two with glaucoma. A minority of people with glaucoma have these genes.
That's correct.
Nevertheless.
That is correct.
So there's more to it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Boy, the genetic thing is, does it make, obviously, or I'm going to say obviously, it would seem to make sense that where it depends that the genetics, if there's genetic predisposition, is different for both the open and closed angled.
Both, well, both open and closed, both, one of the major risk factors is family history. Hmm. In the open, you know, the family history, the problem in with the genes is probably that it's done something to the internal drain to keep it from draining the way that it should. In the narrow angle glaucoma, on the other hand, it's the shape of the eye, really. It's the fact that your mother had a narrow internal drain, and she passed that on to you, so that your shape of
The genes that affect the shape of the eye.
That's exactly right.
Saying,
that's
right?
Exactly right.
Right. Yeah.
So, for example, with a narrow angle, you know, we tend to see narrow angle glaucoma in 2 to 5% of the Inuits, whereas in Caucasians, it's only 0.6% of the population. Mm-hmm. In Eastern Asians, it's 1.5%. Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Yep. All right. Yeah, and the genetics of all this has gotten much, much, much more complex than we ever thought. We thought when we got the genome, it'd be no big deal. But now we know the genes get turned on and off at different times. They have different interactions with each other. Even the environment is now being fairly clearly shown to affect genes and when they turn on and off. And so we have the genome, but now we got more problems because we got the genome and we're understanding it better.
Right.
Is that true?
Right.
All right. So back to this injury. We got this fluid that is in the anterior chamber, in my mind. And we got this vitreous fluid in the posterior chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember my anatomy correctly, that optic nerve is back in that posterior chamber. So how is the pressure in the anterior chamber affecting the optic nerve?
So there are two theories regarding the injury that occurs to the optic nerve with glaucoma. One is the mechanical theory, one's the ischemic theory. Now, what that means is that with the mechanical theory, the idea is that the pressure gets too high and it kind of pushes on the nerve fibers, really squishing them and injuring them. That's mm-hmm. The mechanical theory.
Just like leaning on your elbow at the right place causes you to get a stinger down your arm, or you wake up with your... You know,
the critical difference here is that in glaucoma, it's irreversible, right?
Yeah, and the pressure is permanent, though. I mean, too, it's ongoing and long-lasting, too.
That's exactly right.
Right, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
The ischemic theory is that the pressure in the eye is actually pushing on the blood vessels that supply the optic nerve, resulting in damage to the optic nerve. Mm-hmm. And in actuality, it's probably a combination of both.
Okay. But so nevertheless, the pressure in that anterior chamber is reflected through the eye to the back of the eyeball, where that optic nerve is coming and flaring out all around the back of your retina, supplying those cells that are receiving light.
That is exactly
right. And the injury, as we've already implied in my introduction, starts with loss of peripheral vision. You're looking funny. That's not always true, huh?
Yes and no.
Oh, okay.
Yes and no. So the point being made is that it's not the center vision that goes first.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is you lose your vision in an arcuate pattern, meaning it really is the central 30 degrees of your vision that is affected, but it's affected in kind of a, do you understand when I say arcuate, like a C shape. And so you're not going to notice it really until it marches inward and affects your central vision.
Mm-hmm. Is that because your brain automatically adapts to this loss of this kind of arcuate vision by just moving your head around a little bit more to stay in focus?
That's one way, but more common is glaucoma affects the each eye differently, and it tends to be more advanced in one eye than another.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know that both eyes share... if you're looking at a spot with your right eye, you're also looking at it with your left eye. And so if that spot is dark in your right eye, your left eye is going to fill it in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's you may not notice that.
You won't notice it
consciously.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Because your brain, when it interprets it,
right.
is telling you, nope, it's still there.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only
that's
way
why
you
the,
would
the room doesn't jump around when we're moving all over the place. The brain is actually filling in information.
Yes, that's exactly right. So the only way you would notice it is if you closed one eye and looked with just one eye.
Ah,
then you would see
yeah.
the blind spot.
Okay. All right. And that's what makes this kind of subtle is that it can go on for a long time without symptoms.
That's exactly right, and that's why it's called the silent robber of sight, and that's what makes this disease so dangerous is that there are no symptoms. So the tragedy is that people come to the office saying, I can't see, and it's because they've irrevocably lost vision due to glaucoma. So the critical thing about glaucoma and public awareness of this disease is that if you catch it in a timely fashion and treat it, it is extremely rare to go blind from glaucoma. You know, 95% of the individuals who go blind from glaucoma, that occurs in developing countries. And so, you know, you really, if you can just diagnose it and treat it, you're going to be just fine.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, I guess it bears repeating what you've already talked about, that the loss is permanent, that once that optic nerve, the portions of the optic nerve that are injured significantly enough, that's not repairable.
That's right.
It doesn't repair.
It doesn't.
So when I herniated a disc in my back and I waited a while and the pain was enough that it bothered me, and everybody said, oh, most pain in your back gets better. A small area of my nerve that came down and innervates the outside of my lower leg is now numb because that injury was permanent and it didn't repair itself. And the same thing can happen with nerves anywhere, including the eye, because of this pressure.
That's right. Okay. That's right. And so, again, that leads to taking that to its logical conclusion. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could come up with therapy that regenerated
right.
those nerves? And you know.
Yeah. All right. Glenn, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, I do have glaucoma in one eye. I'm totally blind in the other. My question or concern is, since I'm not as diligent as I should be with my medications, I'm taking Alphagan, Travagan, and something with a yellow cap on it.
Timoptic.
Yes, that one. Not being as diligent as I should be with these medications, I'm concerned that I don't know when my pressure is elevated unless I actually go and get tested.
Mm-hmm.
However, the pressure testing is dynamic. It depends on what time of day mm-hmm. or week or what time of mm-hmm. in my life that I go. So how will I know that the glaucoma might be getting worse?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. First, let's just comment about the medicines. The thing about glaucoma medication, about pretty much any glaucoma medication that you are taking, is that it has a very short duration of action. So any day that you are missing your drops, there is a substantial chance that your pressure is going to be elevated on that day. The more days that you have an elevated pressure, the greater the chance that you are going to be injuring your optic nerve. The way that we determine if you are getting worse is, number one, we look at your optic nerve, because when the optic nerve is injured, it takes on a very specific appearance. And the more injured it becomes, you can gauge that simply by the way it looks. So number one, you want an eye doctor to look at your optic nerve and say, does it look worse than it did 6 months ago? The second thing that we do to gauge if your disease is progressing is we test the function of the optic nerve. And the way that we do that is with what's called visual field testing. So what we do is we test to see if you have any blind spots in your vision that you may not detect, but that we can pick up with these tests. And we follow these tests over time to see if you are losing more vision. The third thing that we do is we check the pressure, but as you've already pointed out, pressure is very dynamic. You know, you may come into the eye doctor one day and your pressure may be 10, and then you come back a week later and it's sitting at 25. So pressure is not a great gauge for determining if you are getting worse, because the pressure fluctuates so greatly in normal and even more so in people who have glaucoma. In fact, the reason we don't use measuring pressure as a screening tool for glaucoma is because it is so dynamic. You know, 50% of the time, people with glaucoma are going to come into the eye doctor and have a normal eye pressure. So again, to summarize, the way that you determine if your disease is getting worse is by having someone look at your optic nerve and see what it's been doing over time, see if it appears that it's getting worse, and number two, whether or not you're losing vision based on that visual field test.
Okay, thank you very much.
So, yeah, Glenn, I guess the issue is don't miss your medicines and get regular screening or evaluations.
Yeah, I'll have to do the evaluations more often.
Right.
Apparently is not going to cut it.
Yeah, and you know, you're not an unusual person. One of the real big issues in medicine is getting people, including doctors, to follow up with their own physicians about healthcare issues, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, good luck.
All right, thank you.
Okie dokie. I tell my patients it took everybody 30 or 40 years to get me to floss my teeth, but I finally started flossing my teeth, so I can't get upset at them. You know, we're almost 30 minutes into this already. I think what I need to do is take our break, Dr. Morgan, and then we'll come back and talk some more about glaucoma. Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll return to taking any calls and emails that you might have for our guest, Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Elizabeth Morgan. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage ophthalmologist Dr. Elizabeth Morgan. She's a specialist in glaucoma, and you guessed it. That's the topic today. We've been talking about how glaucoma develops for the most part, how it injures different kinds of glaucoma. We're going to spend quite a bit of time, I think, in the second half of the program talking about treatment. If you've got questions or comments, our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. You can give us a call locally over the next 30 minutes or so at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. And our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And the usual warning, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on KSKA, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast. We won't be here to answer emails and phone calls. So, to clarify this issue again, is that screening with pressures is helpful. It gives us information, but it's not sensitive enough to be a perfect screening tool in and of itself. One reason is the variability day to day and pressure. Another reason might be, I'm guessing here, you correct me if I'm wrong, is that John has a pressure of X and he has a lot of vision loss, and Jill has a pressure that's the same and has no problems so far.
That's correct.
So there's a lot of variability person to person in their sensitivity, apparently, to the pressure.
Mm-hmm. And for example, there is a specific subtype of glaucoma known as normal tension glaucoma. Okay. And in normal tension glaucoma, the pressures never get higher than what is considered normal, yet the eye still gets damaged to the optic nerve. So obviously, if you utilized pressure measurement as a screening tool in those individuals, you'd miss the disease. You have to look at the optic nerve and you have to see that it's been compromised.
Okay. We have a couple of people holding. I think we should probably go ahead and take some of the calls. So Susan, you're on line one.
Yes, I am.
What can I do for you?
Well, recently when I saw my ophthalmologist, who's been treating me preventively, I understood, for glaucoma for several years, he asked me whether I have sleep apnea, which I do, and that has been treated with a CPAP use for quite some time as well. This was the first I'd heard of that, and I wonder what the doctor can say about a connection between sleep apnea and glaucoma, and whether I perhaps should have my CPAP machine checked to see if it's working properly.
Mm-hmm. Sleep apnea is not an independent risk factor for glaucoma. So in other words, sleep apnea in and of itself is not going to give you glaucoma. But what sleep apnea does is it causes problems with, the medical term is vasoregulation. What that means is that with sleep apnea, the vessels all over your body, including those that supply the optic nerve, clamp down when they shouldn't. And that, in turn, results in damage to that organ. So we see glaucoma in people who have sleep apnea. We also see that the optic nerve damage slows down significantly once that sleep apnea is treated. So in answer to your question, yes, there is a connection. And yes, you should make sure that your CPAP machine is doing what it's supposed to.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Bob, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Thanks, Dr. Morgan, for taking my call. I was at the VA today for my six-month follow-up exam with my ophthalmologist. I've been on glaucoma medication,
Latanoprost. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay,
yep.
For about 2 years, and then beginning about 6 months ago, the VA added primonidine, twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
I understood from a friend who had progressive glaucoma that was getting worse and worse, I guess, that there was a surgery for it, SLT. He availed himself to the opportunity to have that done, and has a very good result. I asked my doctor this morning, just coincidentally, it's a good time for this program to be on, might I be a candidate for surgery because I have end-stage glaucoma in one eye. And he said, well, if we have to go to a fourth medication to control the pressure, then you might be a candidate. I understand they refer surgery candidates to your office for that, so I was happy to hear you're on the program today and answering lots of questions. When might I be a candidate, or what are the circumstances? You can't address my specific condition, of course, but when might I be a candidate for the SLT or whatever surgery is appropriate to kind of stabilize it for the long run?
Sure. Let me back up a little bit and just tell everybody that, you know, we have three basic ways of managing pressure in the eye. One is with eye drops, which, of course, is what you're doing. The second is with laser surgery. And the third is with what we call incisional surgery, where you're actually cutting and sewing on the eye. All of these modalities, again, are designed to lower the pressure. When should one have laser? We have at our disposal a number of studies that have been done, and one of them is called the glaucoma laser trial that was conducted in 1990. And this looked at 203 eyes, and it asked the question, who does better? If they're first diagnosed with glaucoma, who does better? People that are treated with drops versus laser. And what this study showed us is that both groups did about the same. So theoretically, when an individual comes to me and they have glaucoma and I am saying, hey, we need to treat, even at that point, you could be considered for a laser procedure. In your case, the indication for the laser procedure would be if you needed to get a lower pressure. Well, how do we know if you need to get a lower pressure? Well, we watch you, and if you are getting worse at a given pressure, then we know we need your pressure lower. We can do that by adding more drops. We can do that by doing laser. Or we can do that by doing incisional surgery. Does that make sense?
Yes, it sure does. And I think it parallels to the degree I got information this morning from my VA doctor. His comment that, well, if we have to go to a fourth drop to control your pressure, then that might be the point in time where we think you're a candidate for surgery and we'd refer you to Dr. Morgan. So yep, you're right on. Sounds good.
Right. Because, it's very difficult to take four drops. It's time consuming. Drops in and of themselves can irritate the eye, and the more you're using, the more irritation can ensue. So it becomes difficult to be compliant with your medications when you actually have to take so many. Yeah.
Right. And the fact that I have end-stage glaucoma in one eye, that's not really a serious factor in making the decision for laser surgery sooner rather than later?
The thing that's significant about that is you know that your good eye is just that, it's your good eye. So you may want to be a little bit more aggressive at managing your glaucoma because you certainly don't want to be losing any vision in that eye. And for that reason, you may actually want a lower pressure in your good eye.
More drops, you mean, in the good eye?
I just mean a lower pressure, whether you achieve that by adding more drops or whether you achieve that with laser surgery or whether you achieve that with incisional surgery.
So that becomes kind of a discussion between the patient and the physician about what's the best approach.
Absolutely.
That's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And a follow-up question, does diet have any effect at all on this pressure issue?
No. No, there's not any foods that you can eat that are going to have a direct effect on pressure. Now, exercise and weight reduction actually can lower pressure in the eye.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Thanks for your help, Dr. Morgan. Very much appreciated.
Yeah, my pleasure.
How effective are medications in general? I guess the question I'm getting at is what percentage of patients are very well controlled, they're not going to have progression if they're very compliant and the medicines are working?
Roughly 80%.
So 8 out of 10, you just do it, you're going to be stand a good chance the rest of your life, you're never going to have to do anything at
Correct.
All. Correct. 20% are going to, despite everything you try, going to have to address this issue. Is that different between open and narrow angle glaucoma?
Yes, because the therapies are very different.
And we haven't talked about the different needs, the different therapies between the two. So let's talk about that right now.
Okay. So we've talked a lot about open angle glaucoma. We've talked about how we can use medications and laser to reduce the pressure. Now with closed angle glaucoma, the therapy really is to open up that drain, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have a number of options. One way of opening up the drain in an individual who has a narrow drain is by cataract extraction, because what you're doing there is you're removing the lens, which sits behind the drain and can push on the drain, causing it to narrow. And in a way, you're kind of creating more space within the eye by removing the lens, thereby allowing that drain to open up. So it's a nice therapy in individuals who actually have cataracts that are affecting their vision, affecting their activities of daily living, because not only do you provide them with better vision, but in the process, you eliminate their glaucoma. Now, another way that you can deal with a narrow angle is with a laser procedure. And the easiest way to describe this is by utilizing a laser, you create an alternate pathway for fluid to drain. And that's a quick in-office procedure that eliminates your risk of pressure getting extremely high in the eye rapidly, should the drain completely close off.
This is a permanent or temporary fix?
It is a permanent fix.
Okay. All right. All right, Nick, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, hi. I'm in my 40s. I have a family history of glaucoma, and I'm trying to do the most I can to identify if I have problems down the road. I get my eyes checked once a year, and the optometrist does one of these little puff tests where he kind of blows into the eye, but I heard you talking earlier saying that one's pressure can vary, and I guess the purpose of my question is to ask you, what is the most I can be doing in my situation to make sure that I correctly check for elevated pressures and presumably glaucoma?
Nick, let me ask a question. I don't know if Dr. Morgan is or not, but how strong is your family history? I'm just interested in that.
Oh, sure. Grandfather and father both had glaucoma.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the first point is you would want to see an eye doctor, and ideally you'd want it to be the same eye doctor on a yearly basis. The reason being is that individual is going to be able to follow the appearance of your optic nerve over time and detect if there's change. So when you're whichever eye doctor you're seeing, you want to make sure that they are getting a very good look at your optic nerve and they are documenting that in an appropriate fashion and they are commenting on whether or not there is change in the appearance of your optic nerve. The second thing is you want to make sure that when you get the pressure measured, that it's being measured in a very reliable fashion. The air puff test originally was designed to try to eliminate any infectious problems, but what we have found about the air puff test is that it really is not very accurate at measuring pressure because people anticipate that puff of air coming, they squeeze the muscles around their eye, and so frequently you'll get a higher than normal reading with the air puff test. The most accurate way of measuring pressure is by utilizing applanation. And what that means is that we take a very small 3-millimeter surface and gently push it against the surface of your eye and determine how much pressure is required to create a flat plane against the surface of your eye. That is a direct reflection of what the pressure is in your eye and the most reliable way we have of measuring pressure.
So I should specifically ask if they have that testing equipment available.
Correct. Correct.
Again, the type of test, say it again for me.
So it would be called applanation, A-P-P-L-A-N-A-T-I-O-N.
Good. Mm-hmm. Hey, thanks for your advice.
Along with, the thing I've picked up out of this, the most importantly, is that vision, that looking at the optic nerve is one of the critical, and that and perhaps looking at peripheral vision is perhaps even more important than that pressure is what I'm hearing.
Yes, the critical thing is looking at the optic nerve because you're not going to lose vision until 50% of the nerve fibers within the optic nerve have been damaged. And by then, you are going to see damage when you look at the optic nerve. Okay. So that visual field change is going to occur later in the disease. Mm-hmm. Now, just another comment very quickly about looking at the optic nerve. We now have a number of ancillary tests that we do, which have the ability to measure the fibers of the optic nerve and determine if they're a normal thickness. And these tests are very helpful not only in detecting early damage, but also in providing a test that you can then repeat at yearly intervals to see if there's change.
Oh, well, good. Well, thank you. And it is duly noted that it's the looking at the optic nerve and having a continuity with a eye doctor who's able to document changes over time.
So. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's perfectly stated.
Much appreciated.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Nick, you're on line one. Oh, wait a minute. I think that was that Nick. That was just Nick I was talking to. My apologies. Millie, you're on line one.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
My mother had cataract surgery, and after that she developed glaucoma. And I was told that she developed the glaucoma as a result of the cataract surgery. Now, I have cataracts, which are not ready to be fixed yet.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if I have to live in fear with developing glaucoma.
Yeah, so you don't want to have cataract surgery.
Well, I'm going to put it off as long as I can, I guess.
I asked this very question before we came on the air, so here's Dr. Morgan's answer.
Yeah, no, that's extremely rare consequence of cataract surgery. Typically, glaucoma is not associated with cataract surgery. You know, the things that can occur in cataract surgery that may cause glaucoma is if for some reason there was damage that occurred to the internal drain of the eye. Perhaps the lens that's put in at the time of cataract surgery is pushing a little bit against the internal drain, causing the pressure to go up. But typically that's not an association.
So what I'm hearing is either it was a coincidence or it's a very unusual complication of or a side effect of the surgery, so that in general, Millie shouldn't be worried about that.
Correct.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
We got an email that's along the same line, and it has to do with a detached retina that was treated and repaired, and then can that affect glaucoma? And since we're asking these questions, is there any general problem with surgeries of the eye, trauma to the eye, we've kind of already addressed that could cause it, but surgery of the eyes that increases the risk for glaucoma as a general comment? Yes, no, unlikely.
Not as a general comment, mm-hmm. But what happens with retinal detachment surgery is the way that that is fixed is you take a ring of silicone and you kind of place it like a belt around the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And what can happen is that ring of silicone can compress the vessels that connect to the internal drain, thereby creating, in a way, back pressure, resulting in glaucoma. So that's one of the most common reasons that glaucoma can occur after retinal detachment surgery. The other things that can happen with retinal detachment surgery is frequently air will be put in the back of the eye or oil put in the back of the eye, both which can have an effect on pressure within the eye until they're resorbed. So those are the mechanisms that occur with retinal detachment surgery that result in glaucoma.
Another quick email is that from a person who said, my mother was diagnosed with glaucoma 20 years ago at age 43. I've always been squeamish about anything touching my eyeball, so I've never had, I've basically forgone the test. Is there anything else that can be done for people like me?
Well, again, I get back to this point that we've been hammering, which is have somebody look at your optic nerve. Mm-hmm. That doesn't require anything touching your eye.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the key point here. All right, let's go ahead and take somebody else. We'll take John on line 10. How are you, John? What can we do for you?
Well, doing well, trying hard to negotiate these icy streets. But my question mm-hmm. for Dr. Morgan is there any relationship between increased exposure to light, whether it be artificial or natural, and the increase of pressure within the eye? And I'll take the answer off air.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm. No, there's not. That's the quick answer. Light, UV exposure is known for creating cataracts at an earlier age, but there's no effect on glaucoma.
Matt, you're on line one.
So my question is for those that haven't been diagnosed with glaucoma, are there things we can do, good preventive health care, eye care maintenance, so that we actually are less likely to develop it in the future?
No, you just have to get yearly eye exams, be screened for it, because the critical thing, again, is identifying the disease and treating it. And if you can do that, you're going to prevent blindness.
And the references you made earlier about exercise and weight, and it sounds like good sleep habits, all more likely to have good eye health, but none of it really has any connection with glaucoma prevention.
Not a direct correlation with glaucoma prevention, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's take the converse of that question. Are there people at increased risk that need to be more aware of their potential risk?
Mm-hmm. So again, with primary open-angle glaucoma, the biggest risk factors are advanced age, and what I mean by that are people over the age of 60, African Americans. Those are actually three. They're the glaucoma in African Americans is actually the leading cause of blindness, as opposed to it being the second cause of blindness. It is five times more common in African-Americans than Caucasians. And when it does present, it tends to be a much more aggressive disease. The other risk factor for primary open-angle glaucoma is family history, which we've talked about.
How about diabetes? I was kind of looking through my notes. Is diabetes a risk? And if it is, for which kind? And what's the mechanism there?
Mm-hmm. Diabetes is not an independent risk factor. Well, it's a bit controversial, mm-hmm. but think of diabetes as exacerbating a problem that is already there. Diabetes, as you know, is a disease that affects the microvasculature, compromising blood supply to various parts of the body. So if you've already got an optic nerve that has compromised blood supply and then you throw on top of it the disease of diabetes, you are going to get more damage.
What's the newest information about treatment, diagnosis, prognosis? What new information that perhaps we haven't discussed or needs to be reiterated about glaucoma?
I think the things that are coming in the future that are going to assist in the management of glaucoma include things that affect diagnosis, treatment, and even building infrastructures in developing worlds. So let me elaborate a little bit. In terms of diagnosis, what we are learning is that there are ways to image the optic nerve, detecting damage to the retinal nerve fiber layer at an earlier time than we would detect by looking at the optic nerve alone.
Which you said is already, you have to have 50% damage before you can detect it.
Before you get visual field changes.
Ah, okay.
Now, these newer diagnostic modalities, let me talk specifically about one, ocular coherence tomography. What we're doing with that is we're using light and we're bouncing it against the back of the eye and seeing how quickly it returns. And that, in turn, allows us to create a three-dimensional view of the optic nerve. That in turn allows us to see that optic nerve in cross-section and measure the thickness of the fibers of the optic nerve. By measuring the thickness of the fibers, we're able to determine if they're normal or if they're thin. If they're thin, that's an indication that those fibers have been damaged, and we may be able to detect that sooner than we would with the naked eye. So in terms of new things with glaucoma, utilizing these newer devices that help us image the optic nerve is one thing that's going to assist in diagnosis. In terms of treatment, you know, when you're talking about medications, I think the direction of research is really in how to deliver the medications, drug delivery methods. Right now, they're looking at things like putting in little plugs in your tear ducts that have this constant circulation of medication. We have implants which can be put underneath the conjunctiva in the front of the eye that, again, allow constant recirculation of the medication, thereby making compliance better.
We have one more phone call. We just got a couple minutes. Let's see if we can answer Doug's question for him. Doug, you're on line one. And remember, we just got a couple minutes.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call. Sorry to call in so late.
No problem.
I tuned in late. My question's about low tension glaucoma. I've been diagnosed potentially with that. My intraocular pressure is in the normal range, but there's quite a bit of optic nerve cupping and possibly some consequences to the visual field. The treatment prescribed was drops to lower the intraocular pressure still further, Alphagan specifically. But I've seen in the literature that there is some indication that calcium channel blockers might have an off-label use as increasing optic nerve perfusion and a means of treating that condition. Is there is that credible? Is that a possible avenue to treat it?
It is a possible avenue to treat it. Normal tension glaucoma is probably a very different disease than your high pressure glaucoma. And what the calcium channel blockers do is they keep the vessels from spasming down, thereby optimizing blood supply to the optic nerve. So that's the theory. That would be something that you'd want to discuss with your internist. There has not been any studies that have proven efficacy of calcium channel blockers in the treatment of normal tension glaucoma. Nevertheless, it is a reasonable hypothesis.
And that's why it's off-label, that there's no FDA approval, because there's no one's given them the evidence. Doesn't mean it doesn't work. We just they haven't proven to the FDA's happiness that that is effective.
Correct.
And it's not illegal to do that or unethical or anything.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, is it widely accepted that reducing the IOP further is an effective means of treating?
Yes. Again, there was the normal tension glaucoma study, which showed that if we reduce pressure by 30%, we decrease the progression of disease in 80% of individuals.
I see. Very interesting.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Morgan.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call, Doug. Okay. We're in our last minute, and this is where I like to kind of sum up what are the important bits of information that all of us are so bad at remembering everything, so what do we want to make sure we try to remember when we leave this program?
I think that the best way to protect yourself from loss of vision due to glaucoma is with regular thorough eye exams. Loss of vision from glaucoma is irreversible. And glaucoma usually has no signs or symptoms until serious loss of vision occurs.
All right. Well, I appreciate your taking the time. I did miscalculate by a little bit. Let me ask one real quick question again. Is how common is glaucoma in children, and how might it be different, at least in presentation, to people like myself who's a pediatrician?
1 in 10,000 births, so not common at all.
And my understanding of the one case, or maybe two that I've seen in 30 years, they present with a red eye that is obviously pain. I can't remember if it's painful or not. I would think it is, but I don't know. A painful red eye in a pediatric patient, you got to think about it.
Yeah, epiphora, photophobia, blepharospasm, meaning they're going to be tearing, they're going to be avoiding light, and they're going to be winking at you.
Okay. All right, so we see some red eyes that aren't painful is the other side of this question. Well, listen, it's been fast and very well done. I appreciate you taking the time, Elizabeth.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you want to continue this conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find our links at our new website, alaskapublic.org. You can join us next week when we're going to be talking about the eyes again, this time with another pediatric or an Anchorage ophthalmologist, Dr. Matthew Guess, and we're going to talk about cataracts, their development, their symptoms, and treatment. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for all of you for listening, especially those of you who took the time to call and email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.